You're listening to By the Well, a podcast for preachers where we discuss the lectionary readings to help you preach in your communities. I'm Robin Whittaker.
And I'm Fran Barber. Welcome, everyone. It's the fourth Sunday of Epiphany, and today we'll be focusing on Matthew chapter 5, verses 1 to 12, the Beatitudes, the beginning of Jesus' teaching on the Sermon on the Mount. We'll be exploring whether the Beatitudes are telling us how to live or whether they have a more nuanced, more fundamental role than this for Matthew. We'll be talking about blessedness, what it signifies, and touching on Matthew's discussion or Matthew's use of persecution. And today we're joined by the Reverend Dr. Sally Douglas, who is an honorary research associate within the University of Divinity and an associate lecturer within the University of Divinity at Pilgrim Theological College. And Sally is also the minister at Richmond Uniting Church in Melbourne. And Sally has written a book, Early Church Understandings of Jesus as the Female Divine, The Scandal of the Scandal of Particularity. Sally is an interdisciplinary scholar in biblical studies and theology. Welcome, Sally.
Hi, Fran. It's good to be here.
Welcome.
Hi, Robin.
This is one of those passages, Sally, that is so well known that we might wonder whether we can say anything new about it. It's one of those passages where we've just finished saying one line and out pops the other one. We haven't really thought about it. That means that we can perhaps not explore our presuppositions about what the reading means. So to start us off, what are a couple of key features of this passage that you would want people to highlight and notice?
Well, I think, and the other thing about it is it's so familiar too, whether it's from Monty Python or from weddings.
That's right.
Hard for people to get past that kind of stuff and then be able to hear it afresh. So I think the first thing I always want to do is contextualize the passage. And as this begins in the first part of Jesus' teaching in Matthew's gospel, understanding who Jesus is imaged as and understood as in the gospel is really important. And so Matthew, whoever Matthew is, whoever this author is, has this really unique way of describing Jesus as Emmanuel in chapter one. And I think that we need to have that at the front of our minds the whole time when we're interacting with the Matthean Jesus. This is God is with us. That's the claim. And that changes the way in which we hear any of the words that Jesus speaks in Matthew's gospel, because this is God speaking. God is with us speaking, God in flesh. I mean, John has different, the author of John has different language for that, obviously, in Logos and so on. So that when Jesus sits down on the mountain, the context is already, the readers have already been told who this is. This is God with us. And then in the landscape in which the Matthean Jesus is situated, he's on the mountain, which is a holy place already. So then it's elevated even more. And then there's this imagery, Moses has already gone up a mountain and received law, and now Jesus is talking about law. So it has all these overlaying on and interweaving understandings already, and then the disciples gather around Jesus as he's seated. So it's this teaching position. Jesus, who is God, is with us then speaking. And it's the part that we hear today is only a small part of a much longer, so a really long sermon, which is pretty revolutionary from beginning to end, really.
Yeah. And I mean, Matthew is the gospel that people talk about. He portrays Jesus as a kind of new Moses. So he's not just a teacher generally, he's a teacher of the law specifically.
And I think even more, it's like the revealer of the essence of the law. And so this is what's really clear, and we might explore this a bit later with other readings in Matthew, that Jesus is really clear in Matthew's gospel. He's not changing the law. There's nothing like that. But he's revealing what's at the heart of the law from the start, which in Matthew is really linked to mercy. And we may not have time to explore it all, but within this imaging of Jesus as God is with us is really strong links with Sophia, who is also understood as Torah incarnate in intertestamental texts like Baruch. So that's the setting. This is God with us revealing God's dreaming, really. And I think that would be my way into looking at the Beatitudes. Jesus is saying, not that these are great ideas and you'll get, you'll do really well in life if you follow these values. That's clearly not true. This is a recipe for a very different lifestyle, but it's actually saying this reveals who and how God is. And so let's lean in and explore that.
Yep.
So if we're hearing blessed are, and this is Emmanuel, God with us, using that word, how would you describe what blessedness means. I know David Bentley Hart's translation of the New Testament, he uses blissful.
He does.
Which when you hear the audio of that reading is quite strange.
Yeah. I really, really like his translation, partly because it does disrupt our assumptions about what it might mean, particularly because the language of blessed in contemporary context, perhaps more in the United States than in Australia, but still here, has been co-opted for prosperity theology. So, you know, I'm so blessed, you know, I'm praying for your blessing, and it's linked with somehow getting stuff or status, not just accumulation of wealth, different kinds of success, where Jesus is talking about a very, very different thing in this context. And so I really like the language of bliss, and that somehow it's connected with the divine or isness, I would use, who and how God is.
You know, divine isness, I like that.
Thank you. Yeah. I really like it too.
And it's not just blissful. I mean, the way he's phrased it is how blissful the destitute, how blissful those who mourn. I mean, these seem like such startling and contradictory phrases, really.
That's right.
And it's pointing out, you know, just how sort of absurd in some ways that these pairings are, and this Makarios word, which can mean blessed, blissful, happy, content. Yeah. I mean, it's hard to capture with one English word, really.
It really is. And I think, but it helps us to zoom into where the Methodist is coming from, because what he was saying was just as radical then as it is now. And, common world views, they continue today, but in the common era, a really strong view was if you are rich, you must be blessed by God or the gods.
Yeah,
you know, plethora of gods around in Greco-Roman context. And if you're powerful, you must be blessed by the gods. And notions that if you're sick, you must be evil or have done something wrong.
Right. You must
or
have
your
sinned
parents
or,
have sinned.
That's right.
So that's the entire and poor, like you've probably stuffed up in some way.
Yep.
And so Jesus is entirely reversing those constructs in the Beatitudes.
Yeah, and I noticed too in the Corinthians reading set for today, there is that contrast going on. The foolishness of God is wiser than the wisdom of humanity, and that God became weak so that the strong may be shamed. So there's an interesting conversation, you know, for a sermon you could have.
There really, and particularly in that passage, because Paul is linking Jesus to Sophia as well in that passage. So this, the divine isness, which is embodied in Jesus, this God is with us, is around non-violence, because that's part of that stuff about the weakness. You know, Jesus doesn't respond in violence, but somehow yet that embodies God's strength. So it undoes our constructs of power, of divine power. And I think that's what's going on here. And to help us into the passage, I think what's amazing in Matthew's gospel is that, Jesus' image is this fantastic teacher, but he does what he teaches.
Yeah.
He actually lives it. So he says, love your enemies, pray for them. And then we have the account of the passion. And in Matthew's gospel alone, Jesus is really clear in the garden at the arrest. He has the power of all the angels, the legions of angels. He can stop this right now. That's not a question of being weak as in not having power. It's about revealing a different kind of understanding of power, which is nonviolent.
Yes.
Mm. And so he does what he says. He is the gentle one. He is the meek one, meek in the sense of non-violent. You know, Jesus says this, all these things are blissful, and then he lives them and dies them. So it's a profound embodiment of this divine reality, which is really uncomfortable because it's challenging for us now.
Yeah, I was reading an essay by Charles Talbot on grace in the Sermon on the Mount.
Right.
And he talks about the Beatitudes as verbal icons. Mm. So this embodiment you're talking about, I think I'm drawing a logical parallel here, but that these Beatitudes transform us with their strange use of language, but more particularly the disciples who have encountered Jesus and seen Jesus are changed in that encounter, which enables them to then live this strange reality.
Yep.
Or requires them to. It doesn't enable them to. It requires them to. And Talbot draws connections with the ancient Mediterranean world, where it was understood that a highly righteous or ethical god or king, and if you were in the presence of that person, you were changed into the qualities and the virtue and the character of that person. So that really was an interesting key for me.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
In looking at these.
And I think, and so for people like, I mean, Paul obviously has some anger issues he's working through as well, but he's constantly seeking to promote, seems like a strange word, but to advocate for these same values of generosity and gentleness and so like consistently. And I think it's, so he wasn't encountering Jesus as a disciple in the ministry, but his encounters that he claims to experience, his ongoing encounters with the crucified and risen Jesus, have the same character, which draw out the same behaviour, which I think are pretty countercultural for him and for him personally as well, but he still Absolutely. Sees the need for them. I heard this amazing interview around with a linguist a few mm-hmm. weeks ago, and she was talking about the linguistic tests, and she said that the tests are really unhelpful because you can do a test and it can show your literacy scale. She's yep. working with refugees. She said, but that doesn't actually show you what that people can do, because she argued that language was interactive, so that if someone whose English was their second or third language and they're speaking to someone who's they're feeling quite threatened by or judged, they're possibly going to stutter more. Like she does, you know, assessment of transcripts and so on. She's a researcher. Mm. Their language ability in English diminishes. Mm. But if they're interacting with someone who they know that values them and respects them and their relationship, their language skills improve. And it's that, I thought it was a beautiful metaphor for how we are actually changed by our interactions with one another, in that we're not just individual. We are literally changed by those interactions. Yes. And so if we are in the presence of Christ, the one we call Christ, then not just so we go, oh, that's a good idea to be like that. Yes. There's something actually far deeper that transforms us.
I think the other thing here that is at least supposed to be transformative, and I think it is there's a play on time. So we get the blessed are or the blissful are, which is present tense.
Yep.
And then we get these future passive verbs, for theirs will be whatever, you know, the kingdom of heaven will be yours, or you will be comforted, et cetera. So we have a stated kind of, this is the present reality, and then this glance towards the future where, mourning is transformed into comfort and those kind of things.
Yep.
And it reminded me of, there's a famous sort of Nietzsche quote of that says something like, the future influences the present just as much as the past.
Mm.
That is, what our horizon is, what we anticipate for the future, transforms our present.
Absolutely.
And we know this socially, right? We know that, there's aspirational programs in schools around, particularly with third and fourth generation welfare recipients, that if people have no models of going to university, of what a life with meaningful work looks like, they can't aspire to it.
That's right.
That you know, their horizons are low in a sense. So I just want to explore with you both how as Christians, I can think of the negative example. Like I think of myself as a youth in a conservative church where I was so fearful of going to hell that had an impact on my, current behavior, as I would literally pray every night for forgiveness because I was scared if I hadn't asked for forgiveness and I died in my sleep. I don't know why, as a 15-year-old, I thought I was going to die in my sleep, but I did. And so my expectations about the future very much impacted my present.
Mm.
How do we do that in the more positive way? How do we cast this vision as preachers and leaders that hopefully transforms our present living? I mean, that's what the kingdom's all about, right?
Absolutely. Great question, Robin. I think part of it is actually taking seriously, and I don't mean in some literal sense or a doolally sense, but taking seriously the challenge, do we think that these are God's values, so that God isn't revealed in empire-shaped constructions of power, that God is gentle and comes in this non-violence among us in Jesus, but continues, this is how God is within herself, and that it's continuing to be birthed. And so we might not see all of the outcomes, but this is God's intent and she is unfolding it and we can play a part. And I think part of it is getting a bigger sense of our place in things, so that we are caught, like I really love going back to Paul, but I love that sense that we all are members, we all have gifts, but that and we don't have to be Messiah, praise be to God.
Yeah.
But we have a call to do our part and know that it's still, the greatness is unfolding. And I think that can be really hopeful, and that we get a glimpse of what it looks like. Oh, it looks like those who have been dominated by, in our own context, the empires of corporate greed or neoliberal economics or whatever it is, or, family violence, all those things, that God sees that and is with people and is the gentle one who gathers in. It's interesting that this language of gentleness is here, because then in Matthew 11, Jesus talks about I am gentle. Like, it's like an I am statement in Matthew's gospel. I am gentle. Come to me, you who are exhausted.
Yeah, that's right. My yoke is easy. Yeah. And yep.
This is the character of God. And so that we can lean into that. So, and I think it's really important when we read that, the hope in those, it's not valorizing pain. Because you could read this in a flippant way and go, oh, I can't be happy because it said blissful are those who mourn, or I can't be having an okay time because blissful are those who are persecuted.
Or worse, it means you leave someone else in that place theologically because, well, you're blessed.
Yes. Exactly. Appalling stuff.
Yeah.
So I think part of what the Methodist Jesus is doing is disrupting those constructs of thinking that God's with the powerful and giving a word of hope to those who are in the current state of mourning or being oppressed or persecuted, saying God sees this and it will not end like this. It will not end like this.
And I found it helpful too, somewhere I read, I can't remember where, but that in that it's, this is not blessed is the heroic or the stoic, but blessed are those who, though they can't see God coming and all the narrative in front of them tells them the opposite, yet they have hope that God will show up. And not, it's not that pie in the sky hope.
No.
It is that grounded faith
hope
in
this
God as God reveals herself.
Exactly. Here. And the sense, sort of, exactly, Fran, and the sense also, Robin, what you're talking about, that context of growing up in the fearful space of fear of going to hell. It's really interesting that in this passage it isn't blessed are those or those who are called children of God who have the right theological statement.
No, that's right.
Like
no. There's nothing here about doctrine, right? About right belief or like you say, the other things that we sometimes mark
that's right.
good faith
I think,
by.
Yeah, it's important to note here too. So all the disciples have had so far is a calling, not all, as if that's a huge thing.
Yeah.
But they are hearing these things before they've proven themselves in any way
Absolutely.
Or had to prove themselves
Absolutely.
In any way. And that makes the final blessed are you. So throughout it's blessed are they, actually this portrait is you. Mm. Blessed are you. So they haven't actually done anything to earn this divine initiative.
No, they haven't.
So I think that's probably a really important thing to note in a sermon.
Yeah, so at verse 11, that the language there changes in the Greek and it's a you plural, blessings on you or blessed
blissful,
are you.
Yeah.
Which gets back to Talbot's point about how the encounter interaction with God makes you part of the portrait.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I think, I would say from a scholarly point of view here, we're seeing Matthew address his community as much as anything. So this is, a community some decades after Jesus who are, Matthew's gospel seems to have traces of conflict within the Jewish community with those who believe in Christ and those who don't. And we're also after the fall of the temple in 70 CE, so that fundamentally, changed Judaism
at
its time of great disruption and pain and all of those things.
And persecution.
Persecution, exactly. So even though we have no evidence for kind of systematic persecution of Christians, there is a sense of real trial and tribulation. And, I mention that because it goes to your point, Fran, of I think by Matthew addressing his community, he invites us in as every future generation of believers. Like this becomes our story as well as those who, although I want to earmark at some point we come back to persecution because I think that gets picked up in really problematic ways.
Yeah, it does. Shall we talk about persecution
Well,
now?
We can do that now,
I wanted to touch on poor in spirit at some point.
Okay, sure.
But maybe
do that quickly. Let's do poor in spirit.
Well, I'm just interested, Sally. This is one of those things where you could just trip over the words, poor in spirit. Why not just poor? And we know Luke dropped out the in spirit.
Yes.
So just whether you've got any comments to make about why Matthew.
Why the elder Matthew does this. It can be argued to mean different things. Within the context of the passage, my sense is that the Matthean Jesus is still trying to break open this mindset that God equals power and power looks like empire, those kind of links, which is very understandable, particularly when you're in occupied territory. You're praying for God's liberation and I'm pretty sure you'd be really wanting it to be real.
Yeah,
and
practical, real, political.
And the Romans to leave. And so it's it's so easy for us to say things like Jesus is the Messiah without realizing how disappointing that would have been for so many people that this is what Messiah looks like.
Mm. Yes, like a suffering crucified man. Yeah,
who not, makes friends with those who have been ostracized for being sinners, who doesn't overturn Rome.
No.
Even heal some of their people.
Dies a criminal.
Dies in a state-sanctioned murder. Mm. And it doesn't look anything like that. So the poor in spirit in the sense, I think it feels to me like it has to be connected in with some of this stuff about the power that you thought it was going to be like is not what it's like, and it's not bombastic and domineering.
Yeah. A number of the commentaries do say this means real poverty, but it's acknowledging the fullness of poverty, that to be poor economically is often to be poor in terms of your social world,
your morale.
Yeah.
Choice.
It's stressful, right?
Poverty is extremely stressful. And very stressful.
Which gets back actually to David Bentley Hart's translation again, because he uses a very interesting word, abject.
Yeah.
Abject. What does he say? The abject in spirit.
The abject in spirit, which captures that.
Captures more, that emphasises more the latter.
Existential.
Yes. Aspect of that. We should just say for our listeners, we're looking at a couple of newer translations of the New Testament. One is we've mentioned David Bentley Hart, and this came out only in the last couple of years, really, his own translation of the Greek of the New Testament. And the other one I have on the table is N.T. Wright, which is different again. But if you're a regular preacher or leader of Bible studies, both of those are worth having alongside something like the NRSV in your, in your resources. And whatever you do, please don't read the Good News version of this passage.
Is it the happy?
The happy. And, I mean, happy has, I think, just a very naive connotation in our current world, although there are psychologists and others recovering a deeper sense of happiness that is to do with contentment. But, I mean, the Good News, it's a paraphrase, really, for children. And I think our congregations are capable of engaging more deeply than that.
And most children too.
Side rant.
No. Totally fair enough. I think the other part of that destitute or abject in spirit, poor in spirit, is the kicker, is it the next part, because theirs is the kingdom.
Mm.
So the sense is you might think that they're worth nothing and they're in an abject situation because of the empire-shaped constructions of power, but actually they own it. They own the kingdom. And so that's an entire, like, yeah, at the end of this whole sermon, the crowds are still there. So I'm not convinced. I know it says that the disciples gather around, but
they're intrigued.
Yeah, I think there are others there listening. At the end, it said the crowds are astounded. At the very end of the whole sermon, they're there. And so this sense of people in that crowd looking around, there'll be some wealthier people there, probably mostly poor, but going, what?
Crikey.
How can this be their kingdom? You know, it's our.
What's going on?
So I think
here?
That's part of what the trick is in that.
I think there's a nice connection here to the Old Testament reading for the day, which is Micah 6:1-8, which is often a very well-known passage to people because it ends with that classic, you know, what does the Lord require of you? And it's not the sacrifices and lists some things, but it's the do justice, you know, love mercy, and then the walk humbly with your God. And there's something about the justice, the mercy, the walking humbly, that I think those similar kind of ethical emphases are here in the Beatitudes.
Absolutely. And it's because for the author of Matthew, Jesus is not in any way debunking Torah or Jewish tradition. Jesus is Torah present with the community, breaking open its heart, and as in breaking open the truth at the heart of it. And so it's really interesting later in Matthew, Jesus quotes Hosea twice and says, go learn what it means. I desire mercy, not sacrifice.
That's right, which he's deeply steeped in these prophetic texts that are already doing that work with the law. Yeah. I mean, it's not that Jesus came along and for the first time he was a Jewish man going, I've got a whole new perspective.
Totally.
He's in that prophetic tradition of emphasizing and re-emphasizing at different points and in different contexts.
As a Jew.
As Jews did. Yep. You know, this is... Now, we have a couple of minutes left, so let's talk about persecution. A light topic to end on.
You could kick off, Rob.
I wanted to raise it because I think it's rhetoric we hear, and we hear from particular Christian communities. There's a sense that Christianity is under attack, and so this we are being persecuted gets picked up.
Yep.
And ironically, I think, and deeply problematically, it gets picked up often by those in the most power. Yes. So Christian communities that are excellent at lobbying, that are well-resourced, that are, you know, heads of mega churches with their thousands and millions in the bank, and yet they're the ones that are taking particularly this kind of Matthew 5:11 verse and saying, you know, well, if people are having a dig at us, we're persecuted, we're doing the right thing. Mm-hmm. And to me, that almost undermines everything you've been talking about, Sally, yeah. about this challenging the power structures and you know, yeah. So I wanted to name that as problematic. I'm not sure what we do about it, but I think we have a bit of an issue with Christians in the West, I should say.
Yeah.
There are Christians in places like Egypt that face actual and real persecution.
Mm, absolutely.
So for us in a place of power and privilege to talk about feeling persecuted, I think is actually, you know, pretty offensive yeah. to our Christian sisters and brothers.
I think it's probably the result of a fairly unnuanced look at our theological and cultural context. You know, we live in post-Christendom, which means that we as church do look odd.
Yes.
Strange. And that can be a cause for hostility. We might provoke it, or it is actually an occasion for marvelous opportunity mm-hmm. to invite people into this wondrous portrait, for example, that we're looking at today. Yep. And I think sort of to talk about the persecution like that, it's a very sort of clumsy
yeah.
way of trying to express the reality of our context in the West.
And absolutely. And it's difficult to challenge, though, because once people have taken on that identity, it's quite difficult to disrupt it.
It is.
Particularly when it's linked with claims about truth.
Yeah.
Which make it really difficult. But I think you're absolutely right that it's a significant concern. It's funny, though, it only really works in that way if you dislocate that verse 11 from the rest of the passage, which is actually about being gentle and merciful.
And meek.
And meek. Yes. You know, I don't think there's any faithfulness in focusing on one verse and ignoring the rest of that whole section.
Well, it points precisely to the problem of doing that, right? If you read yeah. one voice and verse absolutely. And you've ignored the context, you've allowed it to mean something quite different.
Yeah, absolutely.
So to finish off, I'm wondering, Sally, whether there's a couple of lines or sentences you could give that you would like your congregation to go away with. So, you know, if you conducted a service around this reading and preached a sermon, can you name one or two things you'd want to be sure they went away with?
Oh, I think for knowing from the start that who this is that's speaking, so if we take seriously this gospel, we're taking seriously that here we see the face of God and that we get to see a glimpse of the heart of God. So that disrupts it and changes and challenges everything.
I love something Sauva says.
Yep.
The Sermon on the Mount is not a list of requirements but rather a description of the life of a people gathered by and around Jesus. And to be so gathered is to be saved.
Wonderful. That's a good point to end on. Thank you. And thank you so much, Sally Douglas, for being with us. Sally's actually going to be back next week, so you can tune in again next week and hear more from Sally as we continue with Matthew's Sermon on the Mount. But thank you for listening. You can please rate this podcast wherever you listen to podcasts, subscribe or visit us for more information on our website.
This podcast has been made with the support of Pilgrim Theological College in Melbourne, at the Uniting Church in Australia, and the technical help of Adrian Jackson.